Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Amazon, Verizon, and Yahoo, oh my. Changing times and changing companies in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 18th of April. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody, on this day when the business and economic news comes in a set of three. Three companies, three industries where change is afoot. Get on board or get out of the way. Item the first, Amazon. The company added a short game to its long game yesterday. The long game, of course, being market share in everything. Amazon has launched standalone video streaming service with a monthly fee, just like Netflix, Hulu, HBO, Showtime, and all the rest, only cheaper. Of course, users can binge and dash if they want. No need to sign up for a year of Prime to get Mozart in the Jungle and, say, Transparent. Except, oh yeah, the company has also launched a monthly version of Prime, too, free shipping and streaming included. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains everybody needs a short game these days, and it's called The Future of How We Watch Television.
If I want to watch Game of Thrones, I can sign up for HBO for a few months. And then leave when it's over.
Bye, Felicia.
The only loyalty people have to subscription is good content at a reasonable rate.
Robert Gilinski is founder of the New York Reality TV School.
There's no sense of brand loyalty.
So Amazon wanted to give people a chance to stream video without having to sign up for Amazon Prime for a whole year at a cost of $99, which is what you had to do up until now. Now, monthly streaming is $8.99. But even if viewers can watch for a month and run, services would prefer that they don't make a habit out of it.
They don't want people to churn out at all. It's death to these services.
Jonathan Taplin is a professor of communication at the USC Annenberg School.
They probably spend $100 and some to acquire a new sub through marketing, advertising, direct consumer pitches. If they lose them in 3 months, they're completely screwed.
Which is why Netflix, for example, spent $1 billion out of its $2 billion in net profits last year on original content. But for Amazon, show business is really about its other business, selling stuff online. A year of Amazon Prime is still cheaper than 12 months of video. Dan Cryan is director of media at IHS.
It actually serves the purpose of making that annual subscription look like even better value.
Come for the TV shows, stay for the free shipping on your Christmas gifts. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Item number two in our corporate trifecta today, Yahoo. The company is up for sale. Today is the deadline for bids, and there is some buzz that Verizon is the company to beat. If that deal does get done, Yahoo wouldn't be the first down-on-its-luck internet company to have found itself on Verizon's shopping list. It bought AOL for almost $4.5 billion last year. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York now on why Verizon has such a taste for the fallen stars of digital.
Verizon is good at providing wireless and landline service, but those businesses don't have the fast growth and profitability that gets Wall Street excited. Chetan Sharma is a wireless industry consultant.
Margins on their traditional business have been squeezing, so all the major carriers are looking at other businesses that they can invest in.
Its purchase of AOL and its interest in Yahoo are signs Verizon sees its future in digital advertising and content. Lots of companies say that, including AOL and Yahoo, which both ended up for sale after trying and failing. Wharton School professor Kartik Hosanagar follows the digital economy. He says for Verizon to do better, it would have to leverage its existing wireless customers.
What Verizon was hoping to do is that it can use its consumer data from its mobile business to improve ad targeting, and it could therefore be able to charge higher rates.
Precision-targeted ads are what the best minds in marketing and technology are going after. Data from our phones could be a part of that puzzle. But betting on ad technology puts Verizon into a tough and different competitive landscape, explains Columbia Business School professor Jerry Kim.
Once you start competing against
companies that, that are much more focused on that area. So Google or Facebook will have a say, obviously, in video advertising and probably are ahead in terms of technologies.
By buying AOL and maybe Yahoo too, Verizon is betting it can play the game Google and Facebook are winning, the same one AOL and Yahoo never quite mastered. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, item three, sporting goods. Let's say your kid needs shin guards for that soccer game in an hour. Chances are you have places in mind where you could go get them and pick up, I don't know, maybe those yoga pants you've been thinking about. If you do have such a place in mind, you better do it fast because some of those places are disappearing. Vestas Retail Group filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy today, and part of its restructuring includes closing a lot of the stores that it owns, a handful of Eastern Mountain sports locations, and here in the West, all 47 of its Sport Chalet stores. Those are cuts that are adding to what's been a lot of blood in the sporting goods market of late. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Like so many things, the struggles of the sporting goods industry can be related to the all-too-brief show Freaks and Geeks. In the show, the family business is, in fact, a sporting goods store. Here, the father pressures his daughter to use an encounter with the vice president to shill for the business, because...
We need help.
Mom, tell him to stop, please.
No, honey, this is serious. Those mega stores can offer discounts your father can't.
Consolation to that television family, the megastores have been having troubles all their own. The reason? Their own success.
You've got way too many stores selling too much similar product. Some of them need to go away.
Jeff Harbaugh is a consultant to small to middle market action sports stores. He says part of why Sports Chalet is closing is because it tried to offer too much. Skis, ping pong tables, and scuba gear.
I think it's really hard to do that and be 40 stores. I think maybe if you're 3 stores, you can do it, or if you're 100 stores, you can do it.
Even the biggest chains have been having trouble. Sports Authority filed for bankruptcy last month. John Horan publishes Sporting Goods Intelligence.
Retailing is the most Darwinian business there is. Eventually, somebody gets out there and becomes the most important retailer and becomes the gatekeeper to the consumer for the brands.
He says the likely winner in this will be Dick's Sporting Goods, which can snap up some of Sports Authority's leases. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Oil fell today after talks of a production freeze this weekend fell apart. Equities did just fine, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mark Garrison was talking about Verizon a minute ago, one of the more likely suitors for Yahoo as that company tries to figure things out. Also, apparently interested, YP Holdings, in bygone days known as the Yellow Pages. Yes, one of the oldest of old line companies possibly trying to get in on that internet thing. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood has been looking at Yahoo for a good long while now, and she's here to tell us how all this might go. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So let's move past this whole Yellow Pages thing and talk about, first of all, who might not be in this bidding. A lot of the biggies are like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, a lot of the major names are dropping like flies, which really isn't too surprising because if you think about it, anybody who sees Yahoo as a turnaround job is going to be out because Yahoo's leadership over the last decade, and this is not just Marissa Meyer, I think it's pretty effectively shown that Yahoo is not maybe not turn around a bull. It's just not that kind of purchase. And so I think a lot of people thought it was tempting. You hear about those billion users a month and you think, I'm doing it. And then you realize it's like cake. It's empty calories and you should probably just walk away. And that's why Google and Time Inc., IAC, they're all out.
All right. But Yellow Pages is in, Verizon is in. Who can do something with this company?
You know, I think Verizon can do something. Verizon, to me, is the strongest bid. They've been the most consistent. It starts to make a lot more sense if you stop thinking of Verizon buying Yahoo and you start thinking about AOL acquiring Yahoo. It's basically like a big diamond necklace for Tim Armstrong, who is the CEO of AOL.
Right.
And he has, that company was a punchline. And he's turned it into a $3 billion business thanks to really sophisticated digital advertising and data gathering. And if he can add Yahoo to that formula, all of a sudden the whole thing is a lot bigger and they can potentially take on Facebook and Google in digital ad tech. And that's really what that purchase is all about. And that one's a really easy thing to do. You don't have to do anything different with Yahoo's business. You just serve them better ads.
Do you think there's a chance that the board at Yahoo and Marissa Mayer, the CEO, come to the end of this bidding process and they unpack them all tonight or whenever it is, and they say, yeah, no, we changed our mind. We're going to tough it out.
I mean, I think there's that chance. A lot of insiders say, look, they only put themselves up to sale because of pressure from the board, and Yahoo actually has no interest in being sold. Marissa Mayer wants to stay on. I think that that is a decent possibility. If it happens, I'm sure that Wall Street will punish them harshly for it. So it's probably not the smartest course of action, but it wouldn't be totally outside the realm of possibility, because it sounds like they have not made it easier for potential bidders to come in the door, get meetings, see the financials.
Right.
You got to question their commitment to a sale.
Outliers who could bid on this thing and win. Daily Mail is one over in the UK. I mean, who else might make it work?
Yeah, the Daily Mail is a really interesting one, except that then they are basically doubling down on the content business. And I think we've seen recently that digital media and digital content is a tough business to survive in, as everybody knows. SoftBank is sort of the big dark horse that everybody talks about. And that's because of Yahoo's stake in Yahoo Japan, which is actually profitable. So they might come in and buy just that part of it. And then, of course, there's YP, formerly known as Yellow Pages. This is the weird thing about Yahoo is nobody can figure out what the company is, so it feels like anyone or no one could take a shot at it.
I feel obliged to point out here that in two specific areas, Yahoo is a leader, right? Yahoo Finance and Yahoo Sports take second place to nobody.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And look, they brought Marissa Mayer in originally to focus on those products, and there is still a lot of brand loyalty. So something can be done. If you can make something out of those Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Finance users, then you can maximize what is a really good product. That's why the Daily Mail is interested too. That's good content right there.
We should totally buy it. That's what we should do.
I'm looking in my pocket right now. I got like 40 bucks. I am in.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent and banker, I guess, for this transaction. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Brazil has been having arguably more than its share of problems of late, an emerging economy that is definitely not emerging anymore. The Zika virus and troubled preparations for the Olympics that are coming this summer, and as of yesterday, a president in deep and very serious trouble. The lower house of the Brazilian Congress has voted to impeach President Dilma Rousseff. Daniel Gallus is the BBC's South America business correspondent. We got him on the line from Sao Paulo. Daniel, it's good to speak with you.
Thank you.
Remind us, would you, what the specific charges against President Rousseff were or are, I suppose?
Well, a lot of people think that this is a case about corruption, because Brazil has been in the headlines for massive corruption scandals and money being stolen from the state oil giant Petrobras. But in the end, this is a case about fiscal policy. That's what President Rousseff is being accused. So far, no one has ever managed to find a direct link between Rousseff and any of those corruption scandals. But she is obliged to reach certain budget targets that are set by Congress, and she used some creative accounting techniques that made Brazil's economy appear a lot better than it was. And that's what she's being held responsible for now.
And the state of Brazil's economy, to be clear, is lousy.
Yes, this is the worst recession in over two decades, and a lot of people point to President Rousseff for the problems in the economy. Brazil was one of the fastest growing economies in the past decade, but a lot of that had to do with China's strong growth and the high prices of commodities. But it turned out that commodities never became as pricey as before, and Brazil is now suffering a lot from that.
This was, the vote yesterday was a cultural phenomenon down there. I mean, you read the wire service reports this morning and there were fireworks going off. There were people watching on big screens out in public like you do soccer matches down there. It was quite something.
Yes, and it was all set up to be like that. If you think about it, the Speaker of the House, who is a very controversial figure accused of being involved in many corruption dealings and seen as a nemesis to President Dilma Rousseff, he wanted to turn this into a spectacle. Hmm. The debate went over 3 days in the weekend, which is not even a common thing to happen. Television networks in Brazil canceled all their normal schedules just to run this political spectacle.
Is government functioning at all down there as this spectacle plays out?
Well, some normal functions, I'd say yes. So you'd get education, health, all these things are still being carried forward. A lot of people ask about the Zika virus and the Olympic Games. That's still being taken care of. What is not happening is that Brazil needs many economic reforms that should be approved by Congress in order to come out of this recession and start a recovery. And that's not happening. Congress is pretty much has stopped for the whole period for this political crisis to be settled.
And just quickly, what about the business attitude? I imagine that the businesses had been expecting this, that the markets had been expecting this, and so it is following that course, yeah.
Yes, markets have been reacting positively every time there's news about President Rousseff's coming near the impeachment and ending her government. If you consider that Brazil's economy contracted 4% last year and it's predicted to contract another 4% this year, well, markets, the Bovespa index, which is the São Paulo Stock Exchange, it has gained 30% since January. So how could it happen that in the middle of such a serious recession, stock markets are going up? A lot of that has to do with the feeling that she's about to be removed from power. So stock markets have been reacting quite positively to all this news.
Expectations are everything. Daniel Gallus, the BBC South America correspondent. We got him in Sao Paulo. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
When we see those lines, it's not because we as producers does not want to supply them.
Food producers in an oil-producing country. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 106 points today, 0.6%, went back over 18,004 to be precise. The NASDAQ up 21 points, 0.4%, 4960. The S&P 500 up 13 points, about 0.6%, 2,094. We mentioned Amazon is getting into the monthly subscriptions game. Shareholders entertain an increase of 1.5%. Competitor Netflix disconnected 2.75%. HBO's parent company Time Warner clicked up 0.9%. Today, Verizon showing an interest in Yahoo, as we mentioned, dialed up 0.7%. Yahoo barely budged. Google rose nearly 1%. Today, AT&T up 0.4%. Comcast increased about 0.8% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose just a touch, just a hair, just a tad, to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. With the New York primary tomorrow, a word here about this election and international trade. One consistent refrain this primary season on both sides of the aisle has been promises to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States.
In point of fact, some factory work is already returning from offshore. It's a movement known as reshoring. But not everybody is convinced it's going to be all that. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
A group called the Reshoring Initiative says over the past 5 years, as many as 100,000 factory jobs have returned from overseas. But some in manufacturing are skeptical.
There is simply not a consistent data set where I can grasp the reshoring variable and show it to people, which I would love to do.
Cliff Waldman is with the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. He says, sure, some U.S. manufacturers are eyeing rising labor costs in China or governance issues in Brazil and deciding not to build factories there. But
it doesn't mean that they're closing out the factory in China and bringing that factory back home. That's a strange picture.
A few years ago, Hiawatha Rubber, a small manufacturer outside Minneapolis, did see some employment gains from reshoring. Howard Hauser, vice president of operations, says the firm's customers had quality issues with suppliers in Asia and gave the work to Hiawatha instead.
Yeah, we did bring a couple of, you know, of jobs back, but yeah, that kind of stopped then. So that trend has not continued.
Meanwhile, a promising business line at Hiawatha is unlikely to yield lots of new jobs because the work is highly automated. Gary Burtless, an economist with the Brookings Institution, says that kind of thing is happening at lots of American factories.
But consider this. Since the end of the recession, the manufacturing output in the United States has increased over 20%.
Doing more with less? Economists say that's the success story of manufacturing the politicians aren't touting. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Oil, I mentioned real quick up top. The collapse of those talks in Doha this weekend will likely mean low-ish oil prices for quite a bit longer-ish. And while low crude prices in and of themselves aren't great for oil-producing countries, there is something else that happens in resource-rich economies as well. They tend not to diversify. Oil, in this instance, crowds out other sectors so that when the bust hits, it hits hard. And that gets us to Venezuela, where the biggest oil reserves in the world have pushed out a once-thriving agriculture sector. And so in a country rich in arable land, people are lining up for food. Marketplace's Scott Tong is back from Venezuela not too long ago. Here's his last story from there, a series we're calling Resource Curse.
Before Venezuela found oil about a century ago, the place sounded like this. Agriculture mattered. Ranches provided milk and meat. The country's big export was coffee beans. People mostly worked on farms. Today, after oil, there are food lines and shortages. What happened? Rancher Giovanni Finol is ex-president of the Livestock Federation in the western state of Zulia.
The Venezuelans were fed on food brought from overseas, on imports. Over the past 15 years, the government has been destroying production.
This is a strain of what some call Dutch disease. In the Netherlands, in Venezuela, and elsewhere, oil has crowded out other sectors. In this case, lots of dairy, cocoa beans, poultry. Here's how it works. All that oil sells for dollars, which flood in and, like eBay shoppers, compete to buy the local currency, the bolivar. The bolivar gets bid up. It appreciates. For years, the strong bolivar bought lots of international things, imports. And the government liked it that way, says David Smildy in Caracas. He teaches sociology at Tulane.
In most democracies, the value of the currency is going to be overvalued because they want to be able to import more. They want to have this level of well-being like any democratic politician does.
Here's the trade-off. When people buy imports, they often ignore homemade stuff.
It made it very difficult for local industry to compete. You know, you could always import things for cheaper. It slowly undermined local production.
In Venezuela, that's just one hurdle. There are price controls on food, in effect for more than a decade. And just like the U.S. experiment with price controls in the 70s, government-controlled low prices squeezed profits and producers and made for shortages. Again, Rancher Finol.
For many products, the profit margin is non-existent. Now we are producing where our costs are higher than the selling price.
So agriculture has shrunk from a big slice of this economy to 4%. Venezuela imports 80% of its food now. But when cattlemen here tally their issues, they run out of fingers. Dairy farmer Alberto Zambrano says the government has expropriated, that is, confiscated, ranch land since 2001 on the grounds of land reform. It took his wife's family land.
You don't feel safe to invest, to produce, because tomorrow the government could come and say, this is ours now.
Not to mention local crooks. Extortion and kidnapping and theft are all on the rise. Once Zambrano was with army officers when they caught a bunch of men stealing 70 of his cows.
They instruct the report, they send it to the district attorney, and the thieves were out on the street 2 days from the robbery.
Why does he still do it? Well, ranching goes back 5 generations in his family, and if he tries to sell his land, he says it's worthless. By all accounts, Venezuela has failed to do what a famous intellectual proposed all the way back in 1936, to plant or sow oil, that is, to use petroleum money to grow new sectors, instead of push them out, like food production at a time of mass scarcity.
When we see those lines, it's not because we as producers does not want to supply them. It's that we don't have the conditions to do so.
Now the world oil price bust has brought yet another challenge. There aren't enough petrodollars coming into Venezuela to use to buy imports, and the government holds those dollars closely. One egg producer says he can't even import feed for his hens. So after all this, he'll be selling them for slaughter. In Maracaibo, Western Venezuela, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that this is officially tax day. You've got till midnight, those who still do it by mail, that is. Apparently, some attendees at the Coachella Music Festival this weekend tried to mail their taxes from the tiny auxiliary post office at the campground there. The lady who runs it said at least 10 people tried to mail their taxes this weekend. She also said, and this is a quote, "Why do they have their taxes here? I don't know." End of quote. Here's my quote. Yeah, no, I don't know either. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 106 points today, 0.6%, back over 18,000, if that matters to you. The NASDAQ rose 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 13 points, 0.6%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.